First case in our calendar is 95-1209, Josephine Wagner versus Roche Laboratories and Huffman Roche, LaRoche Inc. Ms. Eiler.
May it please this honorable court, at this time I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
What's your time there?
At trial, the plaintiff, Josephine Wagner, met her burden of proof as set forth by this court in Seeley versus Searle, showing that Roche failed to warn of all potential risks inherent in the drug Accutane. Roche failed to warn that Accutane was associated with a condition called pseudotumor cerebri, and further, Roche failed to warn that the concomitant use of Accutane and Minocin would cause pseudotumor cerebri.
Tanner, would you mind if we went right to the law and
certainly
read all these horrible facts?
Certainly.
Really, some important issues here if you decide to do that.
Plaintiff showed through...
We've got the problem, to me anyway, what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals didn't rule on your assignment of error. So consequently, when you argue that the set-off of the settlement with the doctor should not be considered, it didn't seem to me that that was a very strong argument, because we didn't have reasons not to, to affect the set-off, given no Court of Appeals decision of no liability at all. My question is, given all of the recent publicity that a number of us have seen with regard to Accutane here in Columbus particularly, there have been probably 8 or 10 major articles about it involving birth defects, would it be better for this case, if we were going to reverse on any aspect, to go back to the trial court for a brand new trial on all the issues?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe as far as the set-off was concerned, that the jury awarded Josephine Wagner $350,000, but that verdict was not based upon a representation of all of her damages. The trial court excluded plaintiff's medical expenses in the amount of $51,000 and also excluded the important testimony of her orthopedic surgeon, Dr. John Brems, and his opinion that Mrs. Wagner required extensive surgical and medical care.
Let's assume that those are errors, that the trial judge erred in excluding the medical expenses. We can't weigh that here, can we? And decide that, therefore, that negates the set-off?
I think you can, Your Honor.
On what basis, when you're challenged not to weigh the evidence?
Your Honor, I think that it's a matter of law, that the set-off, the purpose of the set-off, as this court is well aware, is to prevent unjust enrichment or double recovery. Those two dangers are not present in this case because clearly all of her damages were not presented to the trial court. So the verdict did not reflect a total and complete evaluation of all of her damages. As a result, the set-off should not be applied, and the verdict of $350,000 should be allowed to stand in favor of the plaintiff. So I believe that even though the Court of Appeals did not specifically rule on that assignment of error, that this court has the power, because it retains jurisdiction over the entire case, that the court should hold that the set-off was improper.
We certainly have jurisdiction of the entire case, but the entire case that we have has no Court of Appeals ruling on the issue in question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it would be highly unusual. We do that in some original actions, and certainly in First Amendment cases, where we have a de novo review, but we don't really weigh the evidence, do we, in cases with regard to this kind, where we have to make a decision whether the trial judge should have let in the, whatever it is, the $51,000 of damage or expense or not?
Well, Your Honor, I think where you and I differ is I don't believe that that requires a weighing of the evidence. I think that both areas of exclusion by the trial court are matters of law, and it's upon that basis that this court has a jurisdiction to say that the set-off was improper.
So you would have us say that as a matter of law, the trial judge was wrong on excluding evidence, and then go the next step and say even though the Court of Appeals has not decided that issue, we decided, and we decided the evidence should have come in, and therefore the damages would have been more than $350,000, and therefore no set-off.
My rationale is a little bit different than yours, Judge, but it follows the same line, in that the trial court was incorrect in excluding that information. Therefore, the setup was improper. Therefore, the jury verdict of $350,000 should stand.
Are you aware of all the recent publicity with regard to this matter?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Plaintiff presented, I'd like to speak now to the first assignment of error and plaintiff's and Roche's knowledge of the dangers of Accutane. Plaintiff presented three areas of testimony concerning the knowledge of Roche. First was through Roche's own documentation. Plaintiff presented the two documents of Roche at trial, the investigational drug brochure and the addendum to the investigational drug brochure, which clearly showed that Roche knew that in its clinical studies that Accutane would cause pseudotumor cerebri. Furthermore, in those documents, Roche stated that based upon a chemical and pharmacological similarity between Accutane and vitamin A, that Accutane would cause pseudotumor cerebri.
And it was common knowledge, or was it common knowledge, of the effects of excessive doses of vitamin A?
Yes, Your Honor, it was common knowledge. Even Roche's own experts admitted that it was common knowledge back to the 1940s that too much of vitamin A or hypervitaminosis A would cause pseudotumor cerebri. And it's upon that basis, the similarity between Accutane and vitamin A, that lies the connection between Accutane and vitamin A and causing pseudotumor cerebri.
I take it then that you believe that the Napolese assertion that this was only a theoretical risk is not consistent with the evidence you presented. Is that?
Absolutely, Judge. The only experts who testified concerning the investigational drug brochures in Trial Exhibits 57 and 58 were the plaintiff's witnesses, Dr. Peter Elias and Dr. James O'Donnell. Roche failed to present one witness to testify at trial concerning those documents. So it was only the plaintiff's witness who testified, uncontroverted, that the documents in fact stated that Roche knew of this connection between Accutane and pseudotumor cerebri. Furthermore, Roche's own testing bore this out. 5% of the patients who were tested with Accutane developed symptoms consistent with pseudotumor cerebri. It's upon that basis, and that testimony at trial, that Roche should have known of the connection between pseudotumor cerebri and should have warned of that connection.
Before 1982.
That's correct, Judge.
Because their contention is that nobody really got sick in the laboratory tests and in the experimental phase of this and before 1982, so they had no way to know. But in fact, is that different?
Your Honor, that's true. But the point, it's very important to note that only 175 patients with acne were tested with Accutane. It's a very small sample. And in fact, they did know. They didn't have to even rely on their own testing because they knew, stated in their own documents, that Accutane, because of its chemical and pharmacological similarities to vitamin A, that it was acting just like vitamin A and therefore would cause pseudotumor cerebri. When they tested the drug on just 175 patients, they were getting central nervous system problems. And pseudotumor cerebri is a central nervous system problem. So their test results were showing exactly what the connection was, and they ignored it.
And there's pre-1982 documentation that they knew that.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now why should the doctor be in a position, and I recognize he's not part of this because that's been settled, but there was no warning at all put in by Roche with regard to this problem, was there, to medical professionals? We call them intermediaries. What is that term?
That's right. You learned that intermediaries, Judge.
Okay. They were an intermediary. There's no way this doctor would have known, is there? Or anybody would know?
Your Honor, we, as stated in Seeley, the pharmaceutical company is an expert on the drug. The doctor relies, dermatologists and other doctors who prescribe Accutane and other drugs rely on the warnings as set forth by the pharmaceutical company because they are held out as experts on the drug. That's why, as in Seeley, the burden rests upon the pharmaceutical company to warn the physicians of this connection.
And there never was any such warning. On this issue. There wasn't a birth defect, wasn't there?
There was one on birth defects, but as stated in some articles and some lawsuits, that those warnings were found to be inadequate and were subsequently strengthened, and those were found to be inadequate, and they've since become very strong.
So without the warning, is it the knowledge of the doctor about the relationship between vitamin A and Accutane that served as the basis for his liability?
I'm sorry, Ryan, could you please...
The doctor's liability, what was it based on?
The doctor's liability, the dermatologist's liability is based upon his failure to, and his negligence in prescribing Accutane and Minocin together. Minocin is an antibiotic, it's a tetracycline. It was known in the medical community to cause pseudotumor cerebri. And it was well known by Roche and all others in the dermatological field that Minocin was a common treatment for acne. So Dr. Burkhardt, the dermatologist, gave Minocin and Accutane together, both of which had the same side effect. And plaintiff's experts, Dr. Peter Elias and Dr. James O'Donnell, testified about the synergistic effect that occurs with these two drugs. When you give two drugs with the same side effect, such as Accutane and Minocin, you increase the risk of getting that side effect exponentially. That it's not only, Dr. Elias stated, that 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2, that it becomes an additive or an exponential risk. In fact, he testified at trial that the risk of getting pseudotumor cerebri with Accutane and Minocin increased 70%. But back to your question, Judge. We allege that because the Dr. Burkhardt should have known that not to mix Accutane and Minocin together, when he prescribed drugs for Josephine Wagner.
I want to pursue the 5% finding in the test that Roach did. As you know, the athletes argue that the symptoms that were reported by those who were subject to the test were general headaches. What's the burden on a manufacturer of a drug who does a test such as they did here, send it out to people and tell them what you're looking for, and it comes back with indications that there are not harmful effects, or let's say 5% said we've got headaches. And FDA approves it based on their testing. I guess I'm sort of interested in their argument that FDA has a policy against putting all sorts of warnings on bottles of medicine, so that the consumer doesn't, you know, looks at them and you get a whole list of stuff and they become nothing really, so that they don't permit the speculation sorts of symptoms or effects. What's the standard here that was violated by Roche? Assuming that they're correct, and I know you I don't think you agree with them entirely, but let's assume they're correct on their assertion that the study that they did showed no symptoms, that's not the severe symptoms certainly. What do they do in that case? Do they still not put the drug in the market, or do they put a warning on saying 5% of the people report they had headaches, or what should they do?
Well, Your Honor, this goes back to your original question. There was absolutely no testimony at trial concerning most of Roche's argument as set forth in their brief. This over-promotion or the fact that they wouldn't be permitted to put a warning on as to action is simply not in the record. It's just mere argument. Furthermore, the duty of Hoffman and Roche is clearly set out in Seeley. It says that they have to warn of all potential adverse effects inherent in the drug, not just the ones they think are significant, but all. And the reason why that's important, they only tested 175 people who had acne. if you only test 175 people, you may not see a side effect that occurs 1 in 10,000. So you can't just put your blinders on.
Wasn't that testing sufficient for the FDA?
I think it's important to understand the limited role of the FDA. The FDA does no testing of its own, relies solely upon the drug company to supply it all the information on the drug. The drug company does not write any warnings. They rely upon the pharmaceutical company to do that.
The FDA does.
Yep.
FDA.
I'm sorry, yes, yep. The FDA does not write any warnings, relies on a pharmaceutical company. So
this drug was put on the fast track for approval by the FDA. What determines that? Who determines that a drug is going on the fast track?
Well, I think that the pharmaceutical company can petition the FDA that they feel that this drug should be put on the fast track. In fact, this drug was approved by the FDA in 9 months. 400 volumes of material were submitted to the FDA by Roche. Roche's own witness, Dr. Alan Yard, testified that he could not testify under oath that the FDA had in fact read all those volumes. So once you understand the limited role of the FDA, it's important to put that in perspective.
The FDA doesn't make any deterrent, doesn't have any standards or requirements about the number of people who should be tested. 175 patients seems like a small number for a drug of this nature. There are no requirements set forth or standards by the FDA?
There was nothing, I see my time is up, may I finish my answer? There was nothing at trial concerning the number of patients tested. But I would like to point out that actually 500 people were tested with the drug Accutane, but only 175 had the condition of acne, for which is the condition that the drug was eventually approved for. So, all that, with that information, the drug company cannot just look to this limited sample and say we're only going to test on the side effects as demonstrating 175. They have to look to their knowledge and their expertise and what they know about the drug from other testing and say that they should look for the PTC.
The test we set up in Grover versus Eli Lilly is new or should have known. The manufacturer knew or should have known that what they were placing in the stream of commerce had danger. What's your best case or evidence to distinguish Eli Lilly, the case the court appeals most heavily about?
I think that you're, excuse me, Judge, for a point of clarification, you're asking me to comment on Grover?
Grover versus Eli Lilly.
Right. I think that actually Grover is really not applicable to this case because the rationale in Grover was based upon the remoteness of the plaintiff and the drug DES.
Would you accept the test? Because that seems not just to be the test that we've set up, but others have, that the manufacturer had to know or should have known before entering into the stream of commerce. Now, what information is there that they knew or should have known that this drug was dangerous to people like your client?
I agree with the test as set forth in Grover, and the reason why Roche knew was their own documents told them so, Exhibits 57 and 58, that their own testing showed that people were being treated with Accutane and were receiving symptoms consistent with pseudotumor cerebri, such as nausea and vomiting and headache. And third, plaintiff's own witnesses, one of which was a clinical investigator selected by Roche to test its drug. It's upon those three bases that we know that Roche should have known and therefore had a duty to warn in a package insert in 1982 that Accutane caused pseudotumor cerebri and that Accutane should not be given with Minocin.
We will find some or all of that in Exhibit 58.
57 and 58, you'll find that.
What about Exhibit 35?
Exhibit 35 was the videotaped testimony of Dr. Peter Elias, who was a clinical investigator for Roche and therefore had firsthand knowledge of what Roche knew. And it was upon his testimony where he detailed the chemical and molecular structures of both Accutane and vitamin A, and those similarities led to his opinion that because these drugs were so similar, that they were going to have similar side effects. And therefore, the Roche should have warned that Accutane would cause pseudotumor suppression.
Right, thank you.
He did state that Accutane was less toxic than vitamin A, didn't he? Was he the one that, your expert that said that?
In certain instances, Your Honor, but he also, as cited in our brief, he stated how much more toxic Accutane was than vitamin A. He gave he made a comparison between the units of vitamin A and Accutane. He said that a normal dose of vitamin A per day is 5,000 units, and the plaintiff was actually receiving 500,000 units.
Well, the defendant, as you know, makes some point of the fact that Accutane is less toxic than vitamin A. What do you see as the significance of that?
I totally disagree with that. There was actually no evidence of that. The only evidence was through the testimony of Dr. Peter Elias that it was in fact more toxic. And their liability expert was Dr. Bickers, who read one document of Roche, the package insert. He read no other Roche documents, did not read the investigational drug brochures, did not read any other documents, but simply came into court and said, I believe that the warnings were proper because I believe the warnings were proper.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Winter.
Thank you.
Roche, knowing the side effects of vitamin A and that Accutane and vitamin A are very similar, why was this drug put on the fast track for approval?
That was a determination the FDA made because
The FDA makes that determination?
Yes, Your Honor, and they make that determination because when they look at a drug prior to the filing of the new drug application, because there's constant interaction starting in 1973, and you have 8 years of testing going on before the new drug application is filed, the FDA is reviewing data. When they reviewed that data, they determined, consistent with their internal regulations, that Accutane was a new molecular entity which showed promise as a breakthrough treatment for a particular disease. They made that determination and therefore, pursuant to their regulations, put the drug on in the vernacular, fast track, which at that time required them to act within a year. Now it is entirely different with life-saving drugs and AIDS and those treatments. The regulations are basically saying it's an FDA determination made on a continuum. I think that brings out an important point here. Accutane is different than vitamin A. There's no disputing that the two drugs are chemically related. Roche warned about that in its package insert from day one. But Accutane, as you pointed out, Justice Moyer, is less toxic than vitamin A. Vitamin A had been used
in the... There seems to be a dispute in the facts on that. How do we find that in the record?
We find it in the record. Okay. I think, off the top of my head, I know you can go to page 68 to 70 of our supplement for Mr. O'Donnell's testimony, and I'm blanking right now, but it's in our brief, where Dr. Elias said in 1982, the state of the art was Accutane was less toxic than vitamin A in terms of central nervous system side effects. And the important point there is that question and answer follows a colloquy between Dr. Elias and myself on cross-examination about this international units milligram conversion. It is the second or third question following Dr. Elias' explanation, 40 milligrams equals 200,000 international units, which Mr. O'Donnell admitted was wrong. But
I think the distinction between the two points is dose for dose, Accutane was less toxic. I think the claims point was they had given higher doses for the treatment of Accutane.
Actually, you wanted to give less Accutane to achieve benefits than the similar amount of vitamin A. The amount of vitamin A that you had to give to affect treatment for skin conditions, including severe cystic acne, was much higher than the 40 or 80 milligrams, depending on the patient's weight, that you would give them with Accutane. And one of the things that was very important to the FDA is that not only did you use less drug, which means less toxicity, but you had more benefits. Accutane cured a very severe, debilitating skin disease. And that's what led to the fast track. And there, while there are similarities, there are very important differences, and the Court of Appeals, quite correctly, when it reviewed the evidence, saw that.
Well, on page 4 of the appellant's brief, it states that Mrs. Wagner received 80 milligrams of Accutane, and some days even 90 milligrams, which would correspond to 400,000 to 450,000 units, respectively, of vitamin A. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I agree that she received 80 or 90 milligrams on. That is correct. The conversion to international units, Mr. O'Donnell admitted, was incorrect. And I would submit to the court whether or not you convert milligrams to international units is irrelevant, because whatever the conversion, Accutane is less toxic than vitamin A at whatever level you give it, which is why the drug does what it does and why it was put on the fast track.
In your clinical trial, the evidence of dizziness and blurry vision, that all appeared. But as I read the record, nobody diagnosed PCT, and those symptoms were for the morning. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, you are correct that blurriness, headaches were seen in the clinical trials and were warned about in the first package insert, and plaintiff's expert said adequately. No pseudotumor cerebri was observed in the clinical testing. No pseudotumor cerebri was reported in the medical literature or in any scientific study or case report prior to the time Mrs. Wagner took the drug.
Well, why do you, in terms of exhibits 57 and 58, would you address those?
No, Your Honor, because if you look at them, and I think they're block quoted in appellant's brief, it says, and this is a 1978 document, and this is a document, an investigational drug brochure, which goes to the clinical investigators. It says, Accutane and vitamin A are chemically related. These are the symptoms we've seen with high doses, hypervitaminosis A, high doses of vitamin A, and a list is given. Look out, watch out for, I think the words are watch out or look out for these symptoms in the patients you are treating with Accutane. That was a very responsible thing to do because of the chemical relationship. Roche said to the investigators, look for this because it may be present. We need to know that so we can see how the two drugs come out in the profile. So we were telling our investigators to look for papilledema, look for pseudotumor cerebri, and it was not found. I think that proves the responsibility of Roche, and it proves the adequacy of its warnings, having specifically told competent investigators to look for something and having not found it under Grover, under Seeley, that is not known to exist. Therefore, there was no duty to warn about it, as the Court of Appeals correctly found.
Mr. Winter, in your brief, you talk about, in rather colorful language, the twin evils of judgment by hindsight and tunnel vision, and indicate that judges, in the next page, judges and juries are ill-suited to be making such health policy decisions. It seems to me that's our system in this country. I don't know about in New York where you come from, but I know there is in Ohio. And the question is, you go on and say that we ought to follow and give respect to the national system of drug information developed and continuously refined. Don't you produce that information that you want us to follow? Or, in fact, if we have to follow it, we have to make some judgment. How would you have these cases decided?
Your Honor, I agree with you that cases have to be decided fairly. But hindsight and 20/20 vision actually comes from Grover. And that's an admonition by this court in Grover that we can't look at something years later and say, in hindsight, looking at what we know today, could it have been done slightly differently? So I agree with Your Honor, and the wording in that brief, maybe I should have cited Grover explicitly, but I was thinking of Grover. Also, there's a footnote in that where I talk about hindsight, and that was a specific reference to something that was excluded from this case, a subsequent remedial measure, which is in the merit brief and the reply brief, which I think this court agrees is totally improper to argue based on evidence that excluded. And subsequent remedial measures have their own rule of evidence in every state. The only type of evidence is it has its own rule, and I think this court has said, with respect to subsequent remedial measures, that is a real danger that needs to be addressed. And that was in the context that I made that, Your Honor. And I think, if I could finish, Grover, and what this court said in Grover, is consistent with the national policy that the FDA articulates, that you have to warn about something that is known or should have been known to exist, exercising the reasonable caution and activities of a pharmaceutical manufacturer. I think there's no difference between the law of Ohio as articulated in Grover and the policies and pronouncements of the FDA that we set forth in your brief and cited to other courts that have reached similar conclusions. So I think everything is totally consistent, Your Honor, and I did not mean, nor did my client mean, any disrespect in how we articulated that brief. But I think it is important for this court to be mindful of its ruling in Grover, because Grover is good law. Grover is fair law in terms of the responsibility of a pharmaceutical manufacturer, an individual plaintiff, and the needs of our national system.
Would it surprise you to know when we decided Grover that the drug manufacturer didn't think that was fair law?
Well, everyone comes away from with a different view from a case, and maybe now we're also talking hindsight in terms of what a pharmaceutical company thinks about Grover, but I know...
Let me interrupt you and ask a different question.
Sure.
Isn't the number of people tested who the investigators and their subjects was about 100, less than 200 people who had acne, isn't that a awfully small number of persons to test a drug on and then make conclusions that were made?
No, Your Honor, and there's one thing that needs to be put back in context here, and my learned colleague brought that out. There were more than 500 patients tested in that initial period of time, and they break down into various forms of disease, and some of these patients were tested over a period of years, 2 and 3 years, getting doses much higher than Mrs. Wagner. So you get a spectrum of different experiences, different exposures, and then you say, do we have evidence that this drug is efficacious, works for a particular disease? Is there another treatment form out there for this disease? The answer is no. Today, there is nothing else that works like Accutane.
Is there a standard in the trade, so to speak, of when a drug company tests a drug, as was done here? Is there any standard that either, I assume not imposed by FDA, is there any standard that's usually followed by the drug manufacturers?
It's a case-by-case a drug-by-drug approach, Your Honor. I think penicillin was approved after 12 people were treated with the drug during World War II. We have AIDS treatments, cancer treatments that have 5 or 10 patients. We have other drugs that are the second or third version of the particular form of therapy where you have 1,000 patients tested. There is no one rule. It is each drug is viewed sui generis, and determinations are made, and FDA then decides whether the information is sufficient after it sends the drug to its expert advisory panel, which met twice to consider this drug prior to its approval.
I guess there was no evidence here that indicated, any expert evidence that indicated contrary to what you just said. Is there?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we pointed out in our brief, one of the plaintiff's experts said the neurological testing, the pre-market testing was adequate, and all of FDA's regulations were complied with, and nothing was withheld.
Is there any evidence as to how many of the risk group were tested? So the risk group is women who gain weight rapidly, who are childbearing years. There's sort of a category of women that tend to develop this disease. Do we have any evidence as to how many of those women were testified on the 2 to 5?
That evidence was not developed at trial, Your Honor. And I don't know off the top of my head the breakdown of male and female patients who were tested during the clinical studies, but they were both male and female. I can't answer the question on whether there were any patients with that rapid weight gain.
Yeah. under sealing, the test is to disclose all potential adverse reactions. It seems that that word potential is a jumping off point for the arguments the plaintiff makes here. What are there any limitations to that word potential? How is it?
Well, I think if you look at, I believe it's page 16 of the appellant's brief, and they block quote Dr. Elias's testimony on what do you think Roche should have done, and I'm paraphrasing the question, but he says, I would have been suspicious about the possibility, and leaving aside the fact that there is no data that supports that proposition, suspicious about a possibility is not a potential. You're modifying possibility that you're suspicious about it. I think the Court of Appeals was correct in determining that applying Grover and Seeley, that we had no duty to warn. If I could just add one comment, Justice Douglas, in response to your query about publicity. That publicity, yeah, newspapers are newspapers, and they're free to write what they believe is appropriate. Heterogeneity had nothing to do with this case. It was excluded. There was no issue with that respect to Mrs. Wagner. But I would point out to you, and if you go back to Mr. O'Donnell's testimony, one of the articles which Mr. O'Donnell relied upon to show that Accutane was less toxic than vitamin A was a 1979 article which appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, co-authored by Dr. Yoder and Peck, two of the clinical investigators who are in this recent press and publicity. So I think their evidence, their study, supported Mr. O'Donnell's conclusion that with respect to central nervous system, which is what this case is about, Accutane was less toxic and there was no need to warn.
Counsel, following up on Justice Cook's question, what is protocol in terms of warning? Where, for example, the chemical structure of your drug causes you a concern that it could be a problem, cause certain medical problems, but you've had no result that indicates that there. Is that a warning that you are required to provide, sometimes you provide? What's the standard there, I think?
Well, I think, Your Honor, you have to be suspicious or you have to think about the possibility with related compounds. You need to test to see if that linkage holds up in terms of potential adverse effects. If it does not, what happened in this case is what should happen. You warn about what you find. You say the two drugs are chemically related, and then you go forward. Does that answer your question?
There's no set standard. It's your call.
It is the FDA's call, and it is the pharmaceutical manufacturer's call.
So in a case like this, or in a case where you have a drug that its structure is so close to something that has known problem side effects, you could decide to warn, or you could decide to leave that off if you've had no clinical results in your test.
Well, I don't know what you would do if you have no clinical results in your test, because I think you need to take that step. If you don't...
But there's nothing to prevent you from including that warning. If you had a concern here, for example, that wasn't confirmed in the field test, but you were concerned. Because you want the docs to look for that in their tank. Could you have put that warning on?
Well, I think it would not have been responsible. If you test and you do not see, it is not responsible to then say, we've tested, we didn't see it, but we're telling you that it's a possibility.
But that wouldn't necessarily violate the FDA's admonition, don't warn for
number two, don't you think?
Well, it might, Your Honor. In fact, that would exactly be a situation where the FDA says, you've tested, you don't see it, then you don't warn about it. If you've tested and you see it, you warn about it. If you've tested and it's inconclusive, then you make a different judgment.
What is the FDA's role in the preparation of warnings?
They review them extensively. They have their own independent people review the data to make sure that the package insert statements accurately reflect the information submitted. And yes, Dr. Yard testified, I can't swear that someone read all 400 volumes because he's not at the FDA. But he told the jury about his experiences, and he said how thoroughly the FDA reviews things. And the FDA will say, we want this language in there. There's parts of the Accutane package insert that were written by the FDA.
Is that correct? I thought it was solely up to the drug company to prepare the warnings.
The first draft, the initial draft, is prepared by the pharmaceutical company. And then it goes through a review process both internally with the FDA and with the advisory committee of outside experts who make suggestions, who suggest language or say, take this out, put this in, what about this, what about that. There's extensive correspondence between the agency and the pharmaceutical manufacturer as to what can and cannot be said. And that process took almost a year here. One last point, Justice Douglas. You raised
a point
at the outset about the set-off.
The procedural problem.
I tend to agree with you. If you look at what the Court of Appeals did, and the cross appeal, the notice of cross appeal, it was, if the judgment is reversed or modified, please consider. Unless a new trial is granted on all issues, I don't think that question that you raised could be reached. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Winter. Ms. Eiler, you've used your time, which may take a minute for both.
Your Honor, in rebuttal, there's many things to rebut, but the most important is that the defendant presented no testimony concerning the fact that FDA wrote the warnings, presented no testimony concerning Exhibit 57 and 58. And also, I'd like to address just one other point, and that is that Dr. Elias, plaintiff's expert, addressed the fact and the concern that there was no pseudotumor cerebri reported in the clinical trials. And that was because there was no mechanism set forth in the clinical trials to have patients who are having these central nervous system problems, such as headaches, evaluated. And that's why there was no pseudotumor cerebri. And also, it is important that the drug company cannot merely rely on a small sample of people that it tests. The drug company, as an expert in the field, has to rely not only on the results of the clinical testing, but has to rely on the information it knows concerning the drug and its molecular and chemical structures. To allow the drug company to rely solely upon the results of the clinical testing would set up a dangerous precedent, because there would be an incentive to test the smallest sample possible, because then you would not get a lot of side effects.
Well, I guess there's another factual dispute here. Dr. Burkhart, the treating physician, testified that he didn't know in the literature, nothing in the literature before 1982 that indicated there was a connection between Accutane and PTC. And then there's a statement in Appleby's brief someplace that there was not data indicating that there was a connection. Well, is the record going to clear that up for us? Or?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We have the best evidence, and that's Roche's own words. Mr. Winters is trying to distance himself from Exhibit 57 and 58. The fact is, he presented no experts, no witnesses at trial, no Roche people to explain that document. The only people who testified concerning Exhibit 57 and 58, which is the investigational drug brochures, Roche's own documents, was Dr. Peter Elias and Dr. James O'Donnell. And they testified that document clearly stated that Accutane would cause pseudotumor cerebri, period. That's all that's That's the only interpretation of those documents in the record. Roche's interpretation isn't in the record, so it can't be considered by this court. So, Your Honor, the best evidence is their own evidence and our evidence, and that is that by their own hand and by their own admission, they tested, it is clear that they knew the condition of pseudotumor cerebri and Accutane.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Eiler. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor.